that we raised today triggers any issues for you, please contact Lifeline Beyond Blue or your employees assistance program, and we'll put those numbers into the chat function so that you have them there as a reference. Loneliness has certainly been part of the community conversation around COVID, but it's been a much longer conversation. I happened to grow up listening to Hank Williams. I'm named after a country and western singer singing "I'll Take You Home Again, Kathleen," not some beautiful Irish tenor. So we've always heard about and read about loneliness of cowboys, loneliness of lovers who can't be with the people they love, that loneliness is part of the human condition. And it's intimately connected and part of our relationship with ourselves and with others. And I just want to start by just reading this little piece from Olivia Lang's recent book. She says that loneliness doesn't necessarily require physical solitude, but rather an absence or paucity of connection, closeness, kinship, an inability for one reason or another to find as much intimacy as desired. And I think those ideas of connection, closeness, and kinship are some of what we're going to tease apart today, as well as what might sometimes be seen as its opposite, but really it's that paradox of needing to live with both those feelings of loneliness and the need for connection. So Jane, I'd like to start with you. Can you help us unpick these ideas of social connection and isolation, social isolation and loneliness, particularly in this COVID environment? Because I understand you're in Melbourne and you're in lockdown. So of course our thoughts are with our friends and families who are also in lockdown in metropolitan Melbourne and the Shire of Mitchell. So welcome, and I'm interested to hear your ideas on these.
Thanks, Kathleen, and thank you all for being here. It's nice to see some faces that I recognise on there. So I thought I'd give a few of the sort of notes that are from a talk that we did more fully for a CSI Impact webinar that's on YouTube if you want to follow up on this. So essentially, my team's been working with the Australian Red Cross for about 3 years, and initially they came to us and they literally took us into a room and they said, look, we've got all these boxes of material. They're about social connection, social capital, social integration, social inclusion, loneliness. How does that all fit together? There's different people saying different things here. It's really confusing. We want like a model to work from that helps us as a basic kind of social connection 101. And thereupon started a journey where I have to say it's been an amazing journey working with Red Cross, but also kind of intellectually, it's been incredible. I think essentially what I think is a fundamental tension at the heart of our society, which is that in Western cultures, we have a very individualistic and autonomous society, and we've been encouraged to go down that road ever more. If you even just think about recent moves like such as the NDIS, which is very much about buying your own package and not necessarily about thinking about how the community operates. And there's some excellent work by a guy called John Cacioppo all about loneliness and physiological underpinning of it. And he basically says that in spite of this individualistic way we've been taken, the biological fact remains that we are fundamentally a social species. And our nature is to recognize and form and interact social relationships. And so I would argue that a fundamental tension has been going on in our society that has led to this kind of explosion, if you like, of loneliness and social isolation. And so as Kathleen hinted, there are differences between all these different terms. So it's most fundamental. Social connection is about interaction between individuals. And obviously social isolation results from a lack of contact between a person and others. And loneliness is a feeling of being socially isolated. And there's quite a lot of discussion in the literature about how people can have so many contacts but still feel lonely. And generally, the kind of upshot of that discussion is that people can have a lot of contacts, but lack quality or depth of their relationships. And we might wonder why social connection and loneliness are there. As someone said when I was on a webinar the other day, how can people be lonely? There are so many people in the world. But actually, obviously, as we know, if we actually start to think about relationships, they are incredibly complex to navigate. We have to think sometimes about a bit of give and take in relationships. We have to think about how what we do in our relationship today will affect our relationship with this person in the future. So there's a whole lot of things going on in relationships that are actually really quite hard to navigate and take quite a lot of our personal time and emotion. So it is hard. And when we kind of go, why is it so hard? Why aren't people able to do this? I think we should flip that on its head and go, how are some people able to do this? Because it's so hard. There's some excellent work around the nature of our relationships, which is actually incredible in the space of evolutionary psychology in particular. There's a guy called Robin Dunbar who's got some fantastic videos on YouTube who essentially has analysed the patterns of our social relationships and shown that we have around about 5 really close relationships, around about 12 to 15 kind of ally type relationships. Then we have a group of people that we feel are sort of our tribe. And then we can manage about 150 people that we kind of know on a face-to-face relationship. And as I hinted at earlier, all of these relationships have a certain quality to them. As we know, you could be in an intimate relationship that was having very negative effects on you. So there's something about quantity, but there's also something about quality. And with the Red Cross, we actually made a social investment tool, if you like, where we've tried to actually tease all of these issues out in a kind of strengths-based approach. So where are you now and how can you build on that, rather than taking a quite emotive deficit and kind of stigmatizing approach that we feel is sometimes used around loneliness. And so at the very heart of it, as human beings, we biologically seek to belong. We seek to belong to groups. That's how we function well. And belonging to a group gives us identity. It gives us confidence. It gives us roles. And the first rule of when you actually meet someone is to figure out what are you like in relation to them? And our brains are doing this subconsciously whenever we meet someone. So we're thinking about, do we have a shared background? Do we have a shared culture? Do we have shared interests? Do we have shared politics? And in the course of kind of navigating that relationship, once we've established it, the actual real sort of challenge for us then is how to navigate that relationship. And we know that all relationships require things like give and take, and they require repetition. So it takes up quite a lot of time. And as I said at the start, our lives are so busy these days with going around in cars, doing online shopping, all of those things, even before COVID. When you think about the amount of time it takes to establish and maintain relationships, it's kind of not hard to see why we've sort of let this slip. And just to finish up, I guess, there's quite a lot of evidence that when you do feel like you belong, or when you do meet people that you resonate with, there are really strong physiological effects. So sense of belonging and connection gives off all of these happiness hormones, such as dopamine, endorphins, oxytocin, and so on. And some of our work that we've just been finishing up with the Red Cross at the moment is around how do we sort of activate connections? So what spaces and places, what activities, and obviously in COVID world, how do we convert that into online social connection and a sort of hybrid online and physical world social connection that we probably are going to have to navigate into the next few years until someone solves the issue of COVID.
Jane, I'm just about to finish.
All right. So essentially, I see that some of you've been asking for tools and things. So I'll send those to Kathleen, and that's me finished.
Terrific. And Jane, we certainly thank you for that. And we certainly want to come back in this discussion and perhaps end it with some of those practical ideas that you have, both for a COVID normal and once we can actually, dare I say it, you know, touch and hug each other again, we might get back to another way of working.
Cool.
But thank you for that. So it's this complex mix of both how being in contact, in relationship with someone affects us mentally, physically, and how we navigate that relationship that matters in connection. And there's these notions of belonging as well that come into it and who we are as a species. Sophie, I want to turn to you. I know it's early in your work with Upper Hume Primary Care Partnership on participation and engagement, but you've been thinking deeply about these issues of connection and engagement and participation and the collieries of isolation and loneliness. Can you tell us a little bit about your thinking around these areas when it comes to working with rural communities?
Yeah, I think so my colleague Sarah and I, when we were tasked with looking at social connectedness, we started looking at the research around loneliness. And I think kind of Jane alluded to it, you start reading about loneliness and how it's, you know, the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and you start thinking about the health impact, and then you start looking at the research around those long-term impacts, and it can be very, very heavy. And it was such a relief to kind of get to Jane's work, which is actually switching that on its head and looking at the benefits and understanding that loneliness you know, is actually a very helpful evolutionary tool to get you to reach out to people, you know, so there's sort of helpfulness within that. And also that actually every individual has a different need. So loneliness is difficult to social isolation. So it's the gap between your perceived sense and your actual level of isolation. And what they find is that people who have perceived social isolation actually often have the same interactions as those who don't perceive it. It's just that there's this hereditary, I think it's like 51% is actually hereditary, your sense and your need for interaction with other people. So I thought that made a lot of sense when we were looking in the rural aspect, because you have a lot of people who are physically isolated, and some of them are very, very happy that way. And actually kind of in the context of coronavirus, it's no change for them and they're fine with it. And then there are others who are not, you know, not dealing well with it. The other aspect which we thought was really interesting was looking at young people and a lot of that focus on research around, you know, that 18 to 25 year old being the most lonely, which kind of ties into that where people want to have a lot of connections often at that age. It's not so much the quantity, and that really struck us that there was so much opportunity to do those sort of strength-based learnings that Jane was talking about and helping people understand, you know, how to kind of bridge those gaps and also to look at what they've got in their own lives already and how to build on those connections. So that's where we were kind of focusing on, and then it led us down to this this hyperlocal digital community space, sort of like within Facebook. And I don't know whether you'd like me to talk about that now or whether
I'd like to actually just sit with the difficulty of loneliness for a little bit longer. And I'm interested, Jane, that you see it in sort of almost evolutionary terms. It's certainly, it's part of who we are as people. And, you know, Melanie Klein, the great psychoanalytical thinker in the 60s, wrote a beautiful paper on loneliness, where she argued that we all feel that inner sense of loneliness is about a sense of dealing with imperfection, both in others and ourselves, that we need understanding from others to help us manage feelings of loneliness. And when that understanding isn't that perfect mix, we need to learn to be tolerant of that. But seeing loneliness, you see it slightly differently when in that idea that it's a prompt, that it's a mechanism to get us moving. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think that might have been Sophie that said that, but
yeah, but I thought she was referring to your work.
So. Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I have become a convert to evolutionary psychology. I have to admit, mm-hmm. Kathleen, I've read quite a lot of this work, and essentially, it's really quite convincing and compelling. And essentially, yeah, as Sophie alluded to, there's some good evidence that, or suggestion that, loneliness is a response. And so, you know, if we feel that we're not part of the in-group and that we're on the out-group, if you think about it in evolutionary terms, if we were out there on our own in the wilds of the wilderness, we were at risk. And so there's a strong sort of theory that loneliness is a thing that is basically stimulating us to get back with the group for our personal mm-hmm. safety. You know, there's also really good evidence. This is one of the reasons why I kind of steer away from loneliness as a concept, because there's good evidence that people who feel stigmatized by the concept of loneliness get even worse effects. Mm-hmm. So if you feel that you're a lesser being, or that you've got some marginalizing kind of features, then it just gets worse. There's also evidence to show that people who see themselves or as kind of labeled as lonely become more defensive, and mm-hmm. actually, you know, sort of are less able to make those relationships that oddly enough they sort of need.
Which makes me really worry about campaigns against loneliness, when I feel like it runs counter to everything. It just plays into that notion, as you said, of stigmatizing and shaming. And can I also come back to adolescence, because I don't know about anybody else on this meeting, but adolescence was an exquisitely painful time for me. I didn't feel like any group at all. And it in some ways, trying to find your tribe, trying to find and understand who you are, particularly if you don't feel like you're part of the family that you live with, and they don't think you're part of them either, adds to the problem. But you spoke about belonging and loneliness as being essential, and adolescence is such a complex time, isn't it, to try to understand who we are. You know, many of us struggle through adolescence in trying to understand what our own values are, who are we going to become, who are we, and trying to navigate social relationships is really difficult. So can you talk further about that period of adolescence and loneliness and belonging, and trying to do a sort of strengths-based approach, what that might look like? Do you have any ideas yet around that?
Sorry, was that to me? I missed.
Yeah, it was.
Yes, and I have to say, I've actually got two adolescents at the moment, so navigating it together. And actually, this work has been really, really helpful in kind of understanding that. I think, because I've done kind of a bit of youth work, and I've worked with LGBTIQ+ young people, and seeing kind of those opportunities where we have a social group, and supporting young people to just enter those groups has been incredible. And often, like, the research shows that actually just knowing that those groups are there, and that there are people like them, they don't even have to attend, but knowing that they're there has a protective factor. I think also, you know, that those online groups and online communities are also really important spaces for young people. And I think there's always that balance, because, you know, often the internet is seen as these sort of negative places, and people go down those dark holes. But for, you know, for young people, particularly, for example, trans and gender diverse young people who would not have many people that they would belong to mm-hmm. or feel connected to in the broader community, have those online communities where they can connect and have those really deep relationships, which are so important for connection.
Mm. Jane, has any of your work touched on that period of adolescence and loneliness?
I was just thinking, as Sophie was speaking, about a couple of things, I guess, that we've looked at. So as part of another project with Beyond Blue and SANE and some other mental health organisations, we've been looking at online community use. And I thought, as Sophie was speaking, that in rural communities. So we've been looking at the role of online, these online communities for rural people. And one of the sort of key things there, I think, just is that being able to go into that anonymous, almost anonymous space where you probably won't meet the person who's on there, and just kind of saying, I feel terrible, or, you know, has anyone else experienced this? And I think that's particularly challenging for rural communities. Obviously, there's a lot of evidence to show about, you know, confidentiality and stigma in rural communities. So I think online communities can play that role. And there's other quite interesting evidence, I think, about online communities that are more general. There's some good work that's been done in schools where they looked at sort of physical connection, but also online connection. And they posited that that adolescents are kind of seeking to navigate who they are in that space by doing things that we hear about, things like bullying. All those kind of things can happen in an online space, because young people are trying to figure out who they are, and they're trying to kind of figure out their role in the group. Whereas we have all of these, things that tell us who we are. You know, we wear certain clothes, we live in certain places, we have certain jobs, but young people are navigating all that, and they do a lot of that kind of thing in communication spaces that are open to them. So, so I think again, it's just really sort of significant to understand these different kind of theories in relation to these kind of spaces where people can interact.
So I'd like to open the discussion up to anyone taking part today. If you'd like to ask a question, make a comment, provide some information, please don't hesitate to put your hand up and join the conversation. Jenny's the chat function guru in the corner of my screen. So we would certainly welcome anyone's contribution today as well. Is there anyone there, Jenny, or should I?
No, not at the minute. Sorry.
Well, there is. I don't know how to put my hand up.
Sorry, Steph, you just jumped in as I said that.
I know, because I can't find the hand up thingy, and I'm going to have to go in 5 minutes. So I thought, I've got to jump in.
Jump in, Seth.
Well, I've been thinking about, and I put it in chat in case it, you know, didn't get a chance to say it, the fear of rejection and the lack of confidence or belief in yourself, really, and how that can be a learned trait through childhood, through bullying or exclusion because of some of those, you know, perceived features that are, you know, stigmatized, and how we as a society kind of set up certain groups to be excluded, to have more difficulties in engaging and feeling safe to reach out. And so that's what's on my mind, and I wonder if you want to comment on that.
Jane or Sophie, do you have?
I was thinking about, you know, how in some of the reading they talk about you set up a group, but you can't be guaranteed, you know, you say, oh, there's this group of vulnerable people, we'll set up a group. And then everyone's like, oh, yes, well, I'm vulnerable, I'm going to go to that group. It doesn't work like that. So there was quite a lot of research around actually kind of setting up groups. And I think, Jane, you talk about this too, that the best kind of social connections are where the main focus isn't actually about connecting and repurposing. So, for example, maybe if you have a love of animals, going to volunteer at an RSPCA or something, so that it's incidental, your kind of connections are incidental. But you're right, kind of checking out where things are safe, and particularly if you're highly vulnerable. And then, as Jen, you were also mentioning, if you're very lonely, you're predisposed to actually read neutral social interactions as negative social interactions, so you're heightened. But I think having that awareness of the fact that your brain is doing that is actually really helpful. And then also being aware, and I think this is one thing that really resonated with me when talking to my kids, there's, it's sort of like you don't expect to be unhealthy and not do any exercise one day and then be really fit and healthy without the pain of going through that process and without the physical, you know, aches and pains. And often it's the same with, you know, making those connections. Yes, you're going to feel scared, but that's okay. And it's going to be difficult, but it's like a long-term process. And I think actually just understanding that is really helpful.
But I'm also thinking of the, you know, people, young children or young adolescents with either mental health issues or disabilities that impair their ability to read social interactions mm-hmm. and to relate effectively to others. And so, you know, and I think, as you said, it takes energy and effort. It takes more energy and effort to build that relationship with somebody who has a speech impediment or a hearing impediment or, you know, is on the autism spectrum. So, you know, those people are set up to be lonely through no fault of their own. And we don't have often the time and resources to accommodate their needs. So, you know, I think just even the conversation we're having is a reminder of that and to make that space so that we can include and create a safe environment for people who have extra challenges to engage and feel a sense of belonging.
I think I do sort of feel as well that we have, as societies, all become so rubbish at social connection that there is a kind of phenomenon that's growing called community connectors. And one of my PhD students did a study actually of rural communities where we kind of just identified the phenomenon that there were some people in communities who just really wanted to connect people. And they sometimes went to great lengths. I can think of an example where this connector person wanted to get someone who she perceived as vulnerable to go to a playgroup. And the woman was like, yeah, I'll go. And then she didn't. So the next week she said, right, are you going? And she said, yeah, I'll go. And the connector said, right, good, because I'm going to come and pick you up and take you there. And so I think, you know, and it makes you reflect of people who've done that to you in past times where they've gone, no, I'm going to take you there, Jane, kind of thing. And so I honestly think that in our society where we've become so disenabled to do connection, that in a way we have to have these connector people whose job it is to do just this in community. I have a colleague who researches cognitive disability, and we're always having this discussion that it's not the people with the cognitive disability that have the issue here, it's us, it's the rest of us. We just don't know how to do it. We just don't know how to even start that kind of relationship. So we kind of need a bit of a helping hand, I think, maybe. And I kind of wonder if this is a role for the future.
It may be a really important role. And there are, I mean, all of us can think of people in our own local communities who seem to know somebody they can put you in touch with. I guess there's just that little bit of caution in my mind that, again, loneliness is about how we feel. And so it's who you're with when you're alone that matters. So if you're alone, but you're with, you know, wonderful memories, great sense of self, your books, music, art, nature, your pet, it can be a very tolerable and in fact enjoyable experience. Or it can just be desperately, desperately lonely because the person that you're with is not comfortable in that experience. So some people will be quite comfortable, and I'm very aware, you know, older people are often whisked off to groups and told that they need to be mixing with people, and really You know, as Epicurus told us, that gratitude in later life for all the experiences and memory of all those experiences can what tide us through periods of being on our own in later life. So I just get a little bit anxious at the
thought. Oh, look, I totally agree with
coming
you.
In
it's
being
why
terribly
it's good. Why I don't use the word loneliness. When people used to go on to me about loneliness, I used to say, well, how about the Brontes? You know, like, we would never have had the amazing literature that they produced if they weren't lonely and trying to amuse themselves. So I think you're right, obviously. And I think it's kind of, I guess that's why we've kind of gone down the route of, with the Red Cross, producing these kind of investment models, if you like, where you kind of, the idea is to just understand how this works. And, you know, if it's not for you, fair enough, you have some self-understanding. But if it's something that you want to do something about, well, here's a little bit of a helping hand kind of thing.
Okay. So, Jane, talk us through about these tools. So connection is something that many of us need to learn and we need to practice. And my work is in working with people in communities in later life, and many of us need to learn to make friends in later life, and it's a very unusual experience. We don't have someone who'll send us out and saying, go out and meet someone. So talk to us a little bit about the tools you've developed.
Yeah, look, I think it's a journey with these tools, so I can't sort of give you a toolkit box, but we're sort of in a journey to make that. And we basically started off, as I say, with this kind of investment model where we're kind of like, okay, what sort of relationship pattern do people need? And obviously it's a mean, it's an average, so we're all different, so we don't fit into this model that Dunbar's come up with. But then we kind of look at, well, what are the inputs to our social connections? And up to this point, I think experts have kind of said, oh, well, you know, it's to do with emotional attachment and time. But I also now feel personally that it's also to do with reciprocity work. You know, you can't keep relationships up if it's constant take. There has to be something to give. And then just kind of talking to people about, well, what are the outputs of these relationships? And obviously these things can be these great feelings we've been talking about, you know, feelings that come with belonging. But also there are resources that come with relationships, right? I mean, we can, if you know a neighbor and you are going on holiday, you can get them to water your plants, I always think. Or there are people that you know who are great, have great information or advice, and that's where the concept of social capital kind of comes from, and that, you know, we're all able to share resources with each other. So it's kind of what, that's the kind of model that we go through. And I think our colleagues at the Red Cross have been fascinated in all of this in terms of, you know, do connections have to be with other humans? What's obviously the role of, you know, companion animals? We're getting into the world of robots, all of this kind of stuff. Mm. How about people's relationships with God? How does all of this sort of stuff play in? So we've kind of tried to factor that into an early kind of idea of an investment model that I like to think of as the same as when you're figuring out where your super should be invested. But the next, as I say, the next thing that we're about to start working on is a kind of box of cards, if you like, or checklists, which will be what can you put in your community? What's the infrastructure for connection? What can you as an individual do? How about workplaces? And how can social connection bridge the kind of online world? So that's what we're working on, and hope to have that done by the end of the year.
Fantastic. I also think for those of us in rural Victoria, connection with nature and places is another.
Yes, and country. You know,
Sophie, you talked about tools for change as well. Do you have a sense yet of what some of those tools for change you might be thinking about in your work ahead?
Well, we kind of decided to focus on, as I was talking about, these sort of hyper local digital community groups, like the Facebook groups, because, you know, was actually talking about, and it came from Jane's work, is actually focusing on what's already existing, like what already exists rather than introducing new tools. And what we discovered is there's some amazingly active Facebook groups. So, you know, in our local area, very kind of specific geographical areas where, particularly during the bushfires and through COVID-19, you know, you've had a lot of people, you might have 7,000 community members, and they're not necessarily all geographically based there, but their heart might be based there. And looking at those groups and how they can act as, you know, amazing kind of social connectors. They can be information sharing, particularly during emergencies, you know, when the communication isn't getting out. And obviously there's danger there too if misinformation gets out. But looking at how really well-managed and community Facebook groups can actually serve that purpose for connecting people. If you're new to the community, you might go in there and introduce yourself, or you might be a little bit like me and actually be more of a watcher, not a participant. Things, but you get to see what's going on, who's who, what the community issues are. So we're really keen to kind of look into those and understand them a bit more, but also the role of the moderator, because I think the volunteer moderators of those groups are those sort of community connectors, and I think they're really under-recognized. And we suspect also that a lot of the moderators would have jumped on board as, you know, as they wanted to contribute to their community, but maybe with not quite an appreciation of what a big job it would be and what a huge responsibility it would be during things like bushfires and COVID-19. So we would want to really understand that, work with the moderators to understand that, and then also look at tools where, well, maybe, you know, is there a way that those notice boards can put out some of those messages or be those connectors and actually, you know, say maybe introduce a little bit of that dialogue around healthy connections.
So again, it's that sense that this isn't a Facebook saying, you know, bring all your vulnerable, lonely, isolated people together and we will heal them, but much more about, here's what you called it, a hyperlocal
community? It's a geographical term that
okay.
So it's sort of within your community, and so it's sort of self-identification.
So within that geographic community.
So and often it's like, you know, you might identify, I live between two main towns, but I would identify with one of them over the other. So I choose to go into that group, whereas I might not choose to go, you know, into the other one. So there's some self-selection there. But yeah, it's and particularly like with the closure of local newspapers or, you know, paywalls, that means that you can't actually get access to information. These are fantastic ways of connecting and understanding, and then thinking about, oh, well, actually I could, you know, I could connect with that group or do that. One of the interesting things I think through COVID-19 was there was a local group and they decided that they wanted to make PPE for, you know, the local doctors and nurses, and there were people responding that had never responded otherwise, and they were all coming together to do something because they had their sewing skills or they wanted to do it, and that generates really good feeling and really good sort of personal feelings of you know, being able to help, but also community.
Yeah, so that touches on that reciprocity that you spoke about earlier, Jane, that relationships are about that give and take, that if you have that chance of giving something, you're actually joining the community. Again, can we come back to this idea of community connectors? Because Sophie, you gave us an example of what a community connector might, what role that might be. It sort of makes it a little bit more tangible that if they're moderating a Facebook page that is about their community, and that there's some needs that they'll have as well. So Jane, can you talk a little bit about, when you think of that word community connector, you know, other than physically driving and picking somebody up and, you know, taking off, what else might they be doing? What might they look like, and what care might they need in this?
Yes, exactly. I think that's a really good point. I was actually in a webinar from the UK the other day where some high-flying academic from the UK said, I've invented this thing, it's called a community connector, and we've done this randomized controlled trial of it. And I was like, oh! So it is a thing that's international, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, so look, my PhD student looked at some communities in the Wimmera and in Ireland, and essentially kind of identified some criteria for these people, mm-hmm. Which was more than the UK academic who said you identify them through having a twinkle in their eye, was what she said. I thought that's really scientific. So these are, I guess, people who are, you know, motivated, they're kind of sensitive, they sort of look out for people, they're a bit of a sort of local watchdog, and they just kind of get a kick out of connecting people, mm-hmm. and I suppose some of the examples that we had were, as well as the one I've given, you know, there was a guy who was in a men's shed. I don't think he was necessarily the person that ran the men's shed, but he kind of looked out for people, guys in the community that he saw mm-hmm. kind of knocking about, and thought that maybe they should, you know, come to the men's shed. And as he said, you know, he just had a chat with them a few times and eventually, I guess, you know, kind of wore them down, some of them, and got them to come. Social enterprises in some rural communities are another good sort of space for that. We've had the same kinds of stories told about social enterprises. We have had people who've done local Facebook groups as well. And I guess things like walking groups, getting people to go on a walking group or whatever. So kind of soft landing type things, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, the playgroup example I gave was quite extreme, but I think it was a real kind of space of vulnerability. And this person was kind of really quite concerned that this, mm-hmm. this other woman might be really quite marginalized if she didn't try and connect it in. So a whole lot of different activities. And these kind of people that, you know, we probably all know these people. Mm.
And what sort of supports might they need?
Oh, yeah.
So this is a way of recognizing something that they might be doing intuitively, and sometimes they're best left to do the work intuitively because they're
absolutely
doing it well. Sometimes our training is not so helpful.
I think that's such a good point, because obviously there are a whole lot of different jobs internationally that are similar, like navigators and health promotion workers and all that kind of thing. And this was one of the questions that my PhD student Carolyn asked in her PhD was, can a health service harness these people? And ultimately, I think you're right. You're totally right, Kathleen. It's like once you actually kind of legitimize or identify or bring these people into the system, then notwithstanding that, you know, there's all the bureaucratic stuff that would have to go around that, it does change who they are. Mm. I do remember the first time I was out in the community and I was sort of speaking to these guys and I was like, so what would you want? And this woman said to me, I just a t-shirt would be fine. a t-shirt that says bridge the community or something like that. She was, you know, really up for that. I also think you do have to be a little bit careful about, you know, are these people recruiting for their particular I don't know, religious persuasion or whatever. So I think, you know, that you're right, that there are some caveats around this kind of thing. And as with everything social, we know that there are dark sides to social capital as well, right? So it's just, again, why it's not easy to have easy answers for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, cults often have fantastic social capital and don't feel lonely. You know?
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a dilemma, isn't there, in how we work with community connectors or volunteers who have these fantastic skills, but the minute we draw them in and say, well, have you got a working with children check? Have you got a police check? Have you been through a 3-day induction program? You know, it's like what we did to a lot of the women's groups who were able to cook. We had to suddenly put them in industrial kitchens and they all had to do Cert 4 in hand hygiene. So any thoughts about how we manage those paradoxes, that these are the people we want to acknowledge, to celebrate, to identify, and to help us become more connected as communities, to particularly those who may be at risk of a desperate loneliness that can be ameliorated by connection.
I was actually just thinking about, particularly within the, say, the culturally and linguistically diverse communities, or within the LGBTI communities, where, you know, you're always, particularly now with the focus on, getting the voice of lived experience or getting people from the community to talk, and you have these community connectors, and everyone, you know, from all the services go, oh, amazing, someone that we can, that can bridge that. And there's so much burnout and so much extra responsibility. We actually ran an LGBTIQ plus leadership program 2 years ago with such amazing people from their communities locally who'd been really, you know, supporting through the marriage equality debacle, all this kind of thing. And one of the main things that came out of it was that most of the elders actually recognized the impact that it all had had on them. It kind of gave them permission to bow out, because they hadn't realized, except through going through this leadership program and talking about it, the impact it had had on them. So I think as services, we have to be really aware of, you know, how we're kind of jumping onto the community connectors. And then also, and I think there was a comment in the chat just about, you know, once you start looking at maybe payment or getting people on boards and everything, is there a disconnect, or are you actually communicating with the people who it's easiest to communicate with, rather than actually looking at who would represent all the different parts of the community? You know, we just communicate the easiest ones. So I guess the only thing I would say is, you know, having that, the benefit of spreading the load and having multiple connectors who connect with different parts of the community, or just being aware of the biases is really important, and that connection to those communities is probably the most important thing to appreciate that spread.
I suppose as with all social things, there's no one thing that's going to be the answer. So that's not what people want to hear. But I think the other thing that I would highlight in all of this is that one thing about loneliness is that it's become something that psychologists have kind of almost made another illness that you can treat individuals for. And even things like social prescribing is, you know, as you as an individual, you go along to your health professional and they tell you to go to a gym and that's it, you know, as an individual, sort yourself out. Essentially, I feel like this is a societal or community issue. You know, we all need to be helping each other out here. And so I think the notion of community connection, which I'm not saying is a panacea by any manner of means, is it does sort of take it into that community space and say, you know, this is about community. It's not about poor old X who's lonely kind of thing.
Can we talk a little bit about COVID and about the fact that as communities now, you know, we have metropolitan Melbourne and the Shire of Mitchell that is back in lockdown. We have some more freedoms up here in rural Victoria. But what sort, I know that Jane, you've done some work around how to help with connection in isolation. I mean, we're isolating for the very best reasons. I wish in some ways we had a good war song. You know, it's a pity Vera Lynn died, because maybe we could have gone, you know, it's a long way from, I don't know, not being in COVID rather than Tipperary. But it's like that sense of community cohesion that says we're all in this together and we're doing it for each other, for this greater good of a community with less illness and less death. So in thinking about how we talk about connection in a time of isolation, do you have any tips or tricks for us on those things?
Well, it's interesting you should say that we need to sing songs as groups, because that is a thing that gives you endorphins from social synchronicity. And look, I think it also touches on the area of kind of in groups and out groups. So, you know, again, as humans, we love the downside of the concept of belonging is that there are other people that don't belong and they're the out group. And so that kind of was one of my concerns, I suppose, when I was looking at the the public housing kind of issue, and even just starting to read what some of the people are saying about feeling stigmatized and othered, these kinds of situations do sort of potentially lead to this in-group, out-group kind of stigmatizing kind of scenario. And so we have to be really vigilant to that, and look at ways of making sure that everyone feels that they belong, and really kind of overdoing that sort of situation. I guess just more generally, I suppose there are things, there's some good evidence about some things that can be done to help people who feel very marginalized or stigmatized to be part of the group. And that is things like small acts of kindness is a big kind of movement at the moment. And so I guess helping people to kind of connect between different situations of lockdown or other than lockdown by kind of these small acts of kindness is significant. And a small act of kindness can be a phone call. You know, the Red Cross is set up a lot of kind of connection phone calls, I believe, with people who are in lockdown. And it can be an online reach out, you know, how you doing? And those kinds of things really do have a physiological effect that is measurable. So things that help people to belong and feel that they're not being stigmatized are really important at this point.
Maybe we need to have rural messages going to metropolitan Melbourne. I must admit, I love listening to the ABC are asking people to send messages into the towers in their own language. So you're getting this beautiful, rich series of short messages in all sorts of different languages, which has been lovely. Would anyone like to make a comment or ask a question in the last few minutes that we've got together?
Kathleen. Aqua's made a comment that I think maybe she might like to explain here around a bonfire.
Oh.
Did you want to say anything further to that?
Yeah, sure. It was something that was discussed yesterday when I was with a worker doing some fairly backcountry outreach, and we were just noticing that a number of bushfire-affected people were feeling quite disconnected and isolated. Some of them were new to the area, and we were sort of wondering, I mean, exactly what this conversation is about. And we sort of went off, a bonfire would be good because she can attend or not attend. It's fairly anonymous, especially when it's dark. A lot of people can feel more comfortable in that sort of setting. But I guess another issue around that is, you know, with the professional boundaries when you're working with the community, they're quite blurred, and I'd really like some more information or support around that.
So whether lighting a bonfire in the dark with a whole lot of people is going to get across your policies is a really struggling one, isn't it?
Sorry?
But the whole idea that a really good way of bringing people together exactly is to have that sort of bonfire idea, as you said, in the dark, side by side, giving people some privacy. And yet the requirements of our workplaces would say that is an unsafe position to put people in. And, you know, you'd have to have a whole lot of parameters around that to make that a safe event, which would take away the very nature that you're trying to
Because of the 1.5 metre social distancing rule.
And also I can imagine, you know, how you're going to deal with embers, what if a fire gets loose, what if someone gets burnt, what, you know, like I can just imagine the occupational health and safety requirements of running something like that would add to the difficulties. Often organisationally it's hard to do things that you know intuitively would be a good step forward for a community.
Can I also add, I think there's often a thought, well, to bring people together, oh, we must have an event. And that works really well for some people, but not a lot for others. And particularly, as you say, if people are feeling isolated, then or they're feeling very lonely, then their defences are up and they're scanning things for threats rather than actually looking for open. And so I think building on, you know, what Jane was talking about, those random acts of kindness or little acts of kindness, Actually doing something good for someone else makes you feel good as well. So I think, you know, there's often opportunities for looking at ways, well, how could those people who are feeling isolated or lonely or new to the area, what could they do to help others, which will bridge sort of small connections. It's safe because they're not saying, hello, I want to be your friend, but they're doing something helpful. Yeah. But it's helping themselves and it's helping them feel part of the community as well. That might be another opportunity.
I think activities, doing things with each other, like making, a garden or, a community project together, that problem solving together is a good way of breaking down barriers. And also the other thing is repetition. So, you know yourself, if you're waiting for your kids at the school gate and that happens over a long period of time, you do start talking to the people around you. So events are okay, but they're probably not the most super effective thing for getting people together. And just to touch on your point about the overlaps between being a community member and a health professional, in particularly in rural communities, I think that is, you know, I've been researching rural urban for a long time now, and that is like a really super difference between communities and the transactional episodic kind of existence that is had in cities, and like social capital, that has its upside and downside. So, you know, we do, my colleague said to me the other day, who lives near Daylesford, I'm not going in to get a test in Daylesford because everyone will see me. I'm going to have to go to Bendigo because if everyone sees me, that'll affect my business and blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it was like, whoa, that is the downside, right? So everyone cares about everyone else and would help them out, but also there are these kind of embedded relationships.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. Can I ask, as always, for the two or three words feedback for today's session? Thank you so much, Jane and Sophie. I found that a really interesting and quite wide-ranging discussion, and a really, really important one at this time. And I always like it when there's no, I wish there were easy answers, but I like it when we don't try to wrap things up into neat bundles when we can't do that as well. So I'm grateful for you both. Next week we have a focus on economic outcomes, both in COVID and bushfire. So that will be a different slant on our thinking over the last few weeks as well. So thank you, everyone. Stay well. Jane, do take care in Melbourne, and our thoughts are with you as you.
Oh, it's not that bad for me.
So good. I'm glad.
Can't complain.
Lovely. All right. Thank you, everyone.